Thanks very much, Kevin, and thank you for the invitation to be part of this panel this morning. As you all know, the world of bank regulation has seen a tremendous amount of activity over recent years. And this activity has coincided with a rethinking of the role of financial institutions in our societies, and it's also coincided with market-based pressures to change the way that financial institutions manage their risks. And many of the regulatory changes that are occurring are very complex, and both John and Steve are better placed than I am to discuss the details. So what I would like to do is to first talk about some of the implications of the changes that are taking place for the financial system, including the consequences of making financial intermediation more expensive. And then I would like to turn to a few of the broad regulatory issues that I think we're likely to confront over the years ahead. So first, to the higher cost of financial intermediation. Prior to the financial crisis, as you all know, credit spreads were very low, leverage was easily available, financial institutions had become highly interconnected, and large maturity mismatches were common. You might remember it was the time of the Great Moderation. Many financial assets were priced for perfection, and many financial institutions had based their business models on the assumption that nothing would go wrong. And for a while, everything looked like it was turning out quite well. Financial institutions around the world were highly profitable, and global growth was strong. But in reality, risk was being underpriced, there was too much leverage, and little was done to address the building vulnerabilities. The result of all this is that the citizens of many advanced economies have paid a very heavy price. There's also been a very serious erosion of trust in the financial sector globally, with the banking industry suffering considerable brand damage. And quite rightly, many people question how global banks, with all their sophisticated risk models and all their highly paid staff, could have managed risk so poorly. Fortunately, in Australia, in contrast to these global developments, the Australian banks have fared considerably better. But because finance is a global industry, some of the consequences of the events in the North Atlantic are being felt here as well, and no doubt John and Steve will talk about those. So in the wake of all this experience, it's not surprising that regulators, and to some extent financial institutions themselves, have sought to address the various problems. Capital ratios are being increased, the quality of capital is being improved, maturity transformation is being reduced, and banks are holding more liquid assets. Together, these various changes are increasing the cost of financial intermediation conducted across bank balance sheets. In effect, the choice that our societies are making, partly through our regulators, is to pay more for financial intermediation and perhaps to have less of it. And the benefit that we hope to receive from paying this higher price of financial intermediation is a safer and a more stable financial system. This choice has a number of related implications, and I'd like to mention just two of these. The first concerns lending spreads and the return on bank equity. In particular, loan rates are likely to be higher relative to short-term money market rates than would otherwise have been the case. In effect, some of the incidence of the higher cost of financial intermediation falls on the borrowers. In addition, if banks are safer than all else constant, some of the incidence of the higher cost of financial intermediation should also fall on the owners of bank equity, who should be willing to accept lower returns. But of course, the story doesn't stop here. Lower returns on equity are likely to increase the incentive for bank management to take on new risks in an attempt to regain the early rates of return. Lower returns on equity might also lead to renewed efforts to cost cutting, and this could have some positive effects, but if it were to involve cuts to the risk management function, it could actually lead to new risks. And finally, to the extent that investors realise that credit and other risks are higher than they'd previously thought, they might want more compensation for holding bank equity despite the efforts to make banks safer. Now, these various effects, they're all quite complicated and they will take some years to play out. The one change, though, that we've already seen very clearly is a rise in loan rates relative to the cash rate. For example, during the 10 years prior to 2007, the outstanding variable mortgage rate averaged around 150 basis points above the cash rate. Today, this difference is around 270 basis points. Now, this increase is partly due to the global loss of trust in financial institutions, which has led banks everywhere to pay more for funds in the capital markets. It's also due to the strong competition for deposits domestically, with banks prepared to pay large premiums for liabilities that are called deposits rather than wholesale funding. I think it's worth pointing out that a similar dynamic is also occurring in a number of other countries where there's very strong demand for deposits, and that would include the United Kingdom, Sweden, and New Zealand. In Australia, while public attention has clearly focused on the widening spread between the mortgage rate and the cash rate, there's been much less attention paid to the fact that reductions in the cash rate have not been passed fully through into deposit rates. Only a few years back, depositors did well to be paid an interest rate close to the cash rate on their at-call deposits, and not long before that they were paid well below the cash rate. But today, there are a number of deposit products out there that pay around 2 percentage points above the cash rate. This is a marked change from just a few years ago. In effect, what we're seeing as a result of both the market and regulatory developments is an increase in most interest rates in the economy relative to the cash rate. This is something the Reserve Bank has spoken about at length, and it's been an important factor in the setting of monetary policy over recent years. In particular, the increase in interest rates relative to the cash rate has been offset by the bank setting a lower cash rate than would otherwise have been the case. While it's difficult to be too precise, the cash rate today is in the order of 1.5 percentage points lower than it would have been in the absence of these developments. The second broad implication of the increase in the cost of financial intermediation that I'd like to talk about is that there's likely to be less intermediation, particularly across the balance sheets of banks. And this effect is being compounded by a reduced appetite for debt by the private non-financial sector. One area where banks are likely to find it more difficult than in the past is lending to large businesses. Given the current pricing, many large businesses can raise funds more cheaply in capital markets than banks can, even where the credit rating of the business is lower than the bank. In part, this reflects the brand damage done to banking, and this brand damage is unlikely to be repaired anytime soon. With banks paying more for funds and being subject to a range of regulatory requirements, they are likely to find it hard to intermediate between savers and the large borrowers that can go directly to those savers. This will no doubt provide opportunities for some banks as they help businesses connect directly with these savers, but other banks will need to focus even more on lending to households and small and medium businesses than they have in the past. And these structural changes will obviously bear close watching over the years ahead. I'd now like to turn to the related topic of the future direction of financial regulations. It's obviously a very broad topic, but there are three issues that I want to touch on briefly. These are the importance of system-wide supervision, the regulation of innovation in the financial system, and the interconnections between financial institutions. So first, on the importance of supervision. I think one of the clearest lessons from financial history is that the financial sector has an uncanny ability of finding ways of connecting savers with borrowers. When obstacles are put in the way, detours are often found, new forms of financing pop up, new institutions develop, new products come into play. We've seen numerous examples of this in Australia in earlier decades, and there are a number of overseas examples as well, some of which are very recent. This intrinsic flexibility of finance is one reason why the international regulatory community is spending a lot of time thinking about so-called shadow banking. There is a legitimate concern that current efforts to tighten regulation will push activities off the balance sheets of banks, in time creating new risks to the global financial system. While tighter rules were clearly needed in some areas, we need to be aware of the limitations of rules alone. And I think looking back over the global experience of recent years, it seems that in some jurisdictions, rules came to be viewed as a substitute for supervision. In my view, this has clearly been a mistake. The preservation of financial stability cannot be achieved by rules alone. It requires active and competent supervision. Importantly, a good supervisor needs a whole-of-system focus. The supervisor needs to think about the consequences of institutions following similar strategies. It needs to examine closely the interconnections between financial institutions, including those outside the regulatory net. It needs to examine developments in aggregate credit growth, construction activity and asset prices, and how these aggregates are distributed across the economy. And it needs an understanding of how the competitive dynamics in the system are changing. And then, having thought about all these issues, the supervisor must be willing and must be able to act and to constrain activities that pose unacceptable risks to the financial system. And judgment, not rules, is the key here. On this score, Australia has been well served by APRA's approach to supervision, which has had an industry-wide focus. APRA has been supported in doing this by the Reserve Bank and by the Council of Financial Regulators, which has regular discussions about system-wide developments. It's important as the new rules are agreed and implemented that this strong focus on system-wide supervision is retained. The second issue, and I think one that's probably not received the attention it deserves, is how regulation should deal with innovation in the financial system. Over many decades, our societies have benefited greatly from financial innovation. It's delivered lower cost and more flexible loans and better deposit products. It's also provided newer, more efficient ways of managing risks, and it's helped our economies to grow and our living standards to rise. But financial innovation can also have a dark side. This is particularly so where it's driven by distorted remuneration structures within financial institutions and by regulatory tax or accounting considerations. Problems can also arise when the new products are not well understood by those who develop and sell them and by those who buy and trade them. Over recent times, much of the innovation we've seen has been driven by advances in finance theory and computing power, which together have allowed institutions to slice up risk into smaller and smaller pieces and allow each of those pieces to be priced separately. Now, one supposed benefit of all this was that the financial products could be engineered to very closely match the risk appetite of each and every investor. But much of the financial engineering was very complicated, and its net benefit to society is, I think, debatable. Many of the products were not well understood, and many of the underlying assumptions used in pricing turned out to be wrong. Even sophisticated financial institutions with all their resources did not understand the risks either at a microeconomic or a macroeconomic level. And as a result, they took more risk than they realised, and they created vulnerabilities for the entire global financial system. In response to this, a number of commentators have turned their attention to how society might improve the risk-return trade-off from financial innovation. In particular, they've examined the question of how we can obtain the benefits that innovation can deliver while reducing the risks. Clearly, doing this is not easy, but a common thread to a number of the proposals is for greater public sector oversight of areas where innovation is occurring. There are considerable practical challenges in doing this, but I think it is useful to think about how it might be done in practice. Again, I suspect the answer is not more rules, for it's difficult to write rules for new products, especially when you don't know what they're going to be, and the rules themselves can breed new distortions. But to return to my earlier theme, one concrete approach is for supervisors and central banks to pay very close attention to areas where innovation is occurring, to make sure that they understand what's going on, and to test and to probe institutions about their management of risks in new areas and new products. And ultimately, again, supervisors need to be prepared to take action to limit certain types of activities or to slow their growth if the risks are not well understood or they're not well managed by financial institutions. My third and final issue is the interconnections between financial institutions. These institutions, by their very nature, are highly interconnected. They hold one another's liabilities and they trade with one another extensively in financial markets. And these interconnections are an important part of a well-functioning financial system. They've tended to increase over time as finances become more important to our societies and the financial sector has become increasingly globalised. However, these interconnections do bring risks, and addressing these risks has been an important element of the recent global regulatory efforts. And there are a number of dimensions to this work. These include requiring foreign banks to set up subsidiaries rather than branches and efforts to increase margining in financial markets. But the one dimension I would like to talk briefly about is the greater use of central counterparties. These counterparties replace bilateral connections with connections to a central entity whose job is to manage risk. And by doing so, they hold out the promise of a more stable and a robust financial system. They all have a number of complications. So in pursuing these benefits, we need to proceed with care. While a central counterparty reduces bilateral exposures, it does create a single point of failure. If a central counterparty fails, every participant's affected. This means that the risk management practices of the central counterparty are extremely important, and designing and implementing the appropriate regulatory arrangements is an ongoing task. So too is understanding the implications of any increase in the demand for collateral assets that might arise due to the greater use of central counterparties. Another complication is it's typically quite costly for every participant in financial markets to become a member of a central counterparty. This means that some participants need to use the services of another institution that is a member of the central counterparty. If many participants use the same intermediary institution, then an extensive set of new bilateral connections will have been created, and this introduces new risks that will need to be managed. Indeed, since there are economies of scale in the provision of these intermediary services, there's a clear potential for concentration here. And a third complication is that there is not a single central counterparty, and not all dealings in financial instruments will go through a central counterparty. The issue of how various central counterparties therefore relate to one another and importantly compete with one another is important. So too is understanding how the bilateral exposures between institutions change when some type of transactions go through a central counterparty and others do not. These are all difficult issues, and it's very important that we get the details right. So I encourage you all to think about them and to remain actively involved in the debates. Finally, it's worth repeating that the Australian banks have fared better than many of their international peers over recent years. This is partly because of the strong economic outcomes in Australia, as well as APRA's approach to regulation and, importantly, supervision. But it also reflects the Australian banks' higher lending standards than in some other parts of the world and their relatively limited exposure to innovative and ultimately quite risky financial products. So while Australia didn't have a financial crisis, the North Atlantic crisis is having a significant impact on our own financial system. This is occurring through the tightening of regulation and through developments in the marketplace. Many of the changes are positive, and over time they should enhance the safety and the resilience of our financial system. But as these changes take place, all those interested in finance need to do their best to understand the impact of these changes on the cost and the availability of finance. And we should not lose sight of the importance of system-wide supervision, including understanding innovations in both the Australian and the global financial system. Thank you very much for listening.
My name is Steve Cates. I'm with RMIT. I take Steve's point here about markets versus regulation. And, you know, when we've living here in Australia, trying to work your way back towards what happened. It seems to be that this was a very heavy hand of government all over the place in its regulation and its activities. So if you go to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and then you get the Community Reinvestment Act, and then you see the Fed's bailout policies, which they've been doing since Mexico, which has obviously raised the moral hazards in the banking community. I do worry about the fact that we are going to introduce a regulatory answer to a regulatory problem, that it was actually government, and it was only in the United States that all this was going on in particular, that we are looking at the wrong places for and finding the wrong answers.
Thank you. Well, I think part of the problem was a regulatory, the origins of the problem partly were in regulation, and that in the US the policies of the government towards housing, I think, did create large imbalances. But I wouldn't blame government entirely here, because there were two major things that financial institutions were doing, which I, at some point, may have had a regulation may have had a bearing on them, but it was not primarily regulation that was driving it. And the two things were the development of the mortgage-backed security market and the CDOs and the CDO squares. People did not understand the risks that they were taking there. And I don't think that was driven ultimately by regulation. It was driven by hubris within financial institutions about their ability to slice and dice and price risk. And the other thing we saw were the European banks buying a lot of US dollar assets funded by euro liabilities. And that was a big vulnerability in the global financial system. That was not primarily driven by regulation. Again, it was driven by a need to increase the rate of return in European banks. So it's a balance here. There were problems in the regulatory environment, but banks were mistaken in their ability to manage and price these risks. I think the other comment I'd make is really in response to Steve. There is really a loss of trust in financial institutions around the world, and you can understand why the political process, why the people in countries around the world want someone to do something about that, because financial institutions have managed things so poorly. So at a community level, one can understand why our societies want someone to do something about this, because the previous set of arrangements didn't work out well. The issue that I see, one of the issues I see at the moment, is the banking systems globally are not doing enough to rebuild that bond of trust with the public. And the problems with Barclays are just another illustration of that. So if the banking system wants the regulatory pressure to ease off a bit, and it wants the political pressures to ease off a bit, and it wants the pressure from the community to ease off a bit, they need to do more to rebuild this bond of trust. So financial intermediation is about trust. And the banks have... there's been a lot of brand damage, and I don't see much going on at the moment that's effectively rebuilding that bond of trust. And while ever that doesn't exist, our societies will, I think quite rightly, demand that our politicians and our regulators to do something about that. I think it's the banks need to do more as well, rather than just saying, well, you know, regulation isn't the solution here.
Thanks, Kevin. Brad Carr from NAB. Question for Phil and for John. Regarding liquid assets and the government bond market. Given that the banks are expected to make every reasonable effort buying govies and sevies before relying on the committed liquidity facility and may have a cap on that, is there a concern that banks may essentially crowd out other domestic investors like life companies and insurers in those assets? And perhaps, John, in that event, in terms of APRA's supervision of insurers and superannuation funds, do you have a view on what other kind of securities you'd want them to invest in instead in their liquidity portfolio? Thank you.
Perhaps I'll start off. The design of our liquidity facility arrangement was designed that way so that it would not crowd out other buyers in the government securities market, because clearly the stock of government securities on issue is not large enough to meet the banks. liquidity requirements. And so we've got this facility, and I think that that will prevent the crowding out. The really big demander, of course, of Australian government securities are overseas residents. I mean, the stock, I think around 78% of the current stock of government securities at the moment are owned by overseas residents. So that's where the really big demand is coming from, not from the Australian banks having to hold government securities for their liquidity purposes. And I think kind of from a high-level public policy point of view, it's entirely appropriate for the central bank to offer this type of facility to promise to liquefy certain securities in a stress environment. That's what central banks are supposed to do. It's also appropriate for the banks to pay a small fee, a small standing fee for doing that, because if they were to hold government securities on their balance sheet rather than private sector securities, they would earn a lower rate of return. So they're earning a higher rate of return, and some of because the government securities on issue are not there, and part of that extra higher rate of return is reflected in this fee that is paid to the Reserve Bank. So I think that set of arrangements is perfectly consistent with what an appropriate policy for a central bank is, and it should not lead to stresses in the government securities market.
Glenn Barnes of Australian Unity. My question has a similar tenor to the last one, but slightly different. And it's to do with the way Basel has perhaps looked at the problems we've had over the last decade, some of which were caused by deregulation. And we seem to have taken a regulatory approach of supervision and capital to attack very complex issues to do with bank balance sheets. And I just wondered to what degree Basel debated the issues that have been raised by some commentators, and I think Mervyn King of the Bank of England has raised this, which is taking the risk associated with complex trading, complex products, and the large corporate sector back out of our traditional trading banks and leaving those trading banks with the basic depository and payment system and giving relative stability to that and managing the more complex risks outside the domain of the main bank balance sheets, where I would deny or claim that even the most sophisticated of analysts on a given day would have real trouble getting to understand the risks and rewards inherent with our major four balance sheets that are relatively well published and crawled over in Australia. And did Basel debate this, and on what basis did they reject a partial structural change to reducing the risk in the financial system?
Well, I just agree with John. The balance sheets of the Australian banks are relatively simple by global standards, and they're fairly transparent, and they're going to become more transparent. So the idea that we need to break this apart, I don't think is high on anyone's agenda here. There's a broader issue for the investment banks. It comes back to the discussion about transparency, and I just refer back to the problems at JP Morgan recently. You know, they thought those highly skilled management in that institution thought they were actually reducing risk. But it turned out that the trades that they'd implemented were increasing risk. And that's a mistake that they made with incredible visibility of what was going on within the institution. So it strikes me as very hard for someone outside the institution to ever make an assessment of how they're doing the risk management, when even the people inside, with all their skills and access to every piece of information, can't make that assessment. It makes you sceptical about complicated risk management strategies. And I think going forward, we're going to... The regulatory community needs to address this. How can the regulators and financial institutions gain greater comfort that if they're pursuing fairly complicated risk management strategies, that those strategies are going to work out under a whole bunch of scenarios? I don't think that requires structural separation, but it requires a much greater focus than the regulatory community has to date, and the bank management to date, on understanding their basic risk, which, you know, it's, at the end of the day, that's their basic job of a financial institution. And they've done it so poorly. And I'm not sure that you can fix that problem through regulation. You've got to have a change of mindset. The supervisors have to be asking tough questions, and the management have to be held to account for answering those questions. And they need to be asked. And I think kind of playing around with the structure of the financial system, structural separation, I don't think this is the right solution here. It's got to be a change in mindset of the supervisor and the institution being supervised.
Hi, John Drury from the Australian newspaper. Philip, you may have answered my question in your last answer, but I was intrigued when you said that that the banks themselves weren't doing enough to improve their level of trust in the market. Exactly how you know, what are you expecting the banks to do? What should they do? And in terms of your last question, when you talked about the need for a fundamental change to risk management and, you know, more emphasis put on at bank and regulator levels, how does one go about doing that?
Thanks, John. I think those questions are actually better directed towards Steve rather than to me, because I don't know what banks have to do to improve the trust, but that should be high on their agenda, so I hope they're thinking about it. But I think banks should be looking at more simplified risk management strategies, because one of the takeaways from the recent experience for me is that the management of banks just don't understand the risks that they're running. And it's because the strategies they're pursuing and the instruments they're using and the products that have been structured are very complicated. And they've relied on finance theory to manage the risk, and it turned out that the assumptions under which much of this has been done have been wrong in a stress environment. Most of the time the assumptions are okay, but in a stress environment the assumptions have turned out to be wrong, and that's really where you need to manage risk. So I don't know how this is going to be achieved in practice. Steve might have a better answer than I do, but I think we financial institutions need to look at simplified risk management strategies, and if they don't, they won't be able to earn back the trust of the markets, because people just say, well, you know, you told me these risks were managed effectively, and they were not. And while ever that complexity exists, I think that lack of trust from financial markets is going to remain. How to build trust with the community, that's a bigger issue. I don't